Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. The number of great apes around the globe have drastically plummeted. The recent discovery of a new species of orangutans has amplified the call for conservation and the protection of wildlife. Earlier this month, a team of scientists welcomed a new species of orangutan into the great ape family. The Tapa Nuli orangutan lives in the Batang Toru Forest on the Sumatra Island in Indonesia. With a population of just 800, the Tapa Nuli orangutan is the most endangered of all great apes. According to the Orangutan Conservancy, there are between 50,000 and 65,000 orangutans left in the wild. 2,000 to 3,000 are killed every year. At this rate of loss, many experts believe orangutans could be extinct in the wild in less than 50 years. Some of the main factors threatening their survival include the loss of habitat through deforestation, palm oil plantations, this is a huge issue, illegal hunting, and the illegal pet trade. So what is being done to protect orangutans? Today we are joined by Dr. Ian Singleton, Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation, a nonprofit focusing on nature and species conservation and environmental education in Switzerland and Indonesia. He's also scientific director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program, and he's co-author of a paper published in the scientific journal Current Biology about this new species. Dr. Ian Singleton lives in Indonesia, but he is here in the Bay Area giving talks, and he joins us in studio. Hi, Ian. Thank you for coming in.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. First off, tell us the meaning behind the word orangutan.
It's basically two words. It's orang, which means people, and hutan, which means forest. So orangutan basically means the people of the forest.
You've lived in Indonesia for 21 years?
Yeah, full-time since 1996, really. Yeah.
How did you get involved in this work, and why did you decide to dedicate your life to saving orangutans?
I used to be a zookeeper. I used to work at a couple of zoos in the UK, and I ended up working at Jersey Zoo in the Channel Islands near France with orangutans. And then eventually in 1996, I had the chance to go and study them in the wild for a PhD. So I did that and never came back.
What do you love about orangutans?
They're different. If you go to the zoo and you see chimpanzees and gorillas, you'll see them behaving in a way that's very similar to humans. And when you interpret their behavior in an anthropomorphic kind of way, you'll most of the time get it right. Orangutans tend to do things for different reasons. They're much more solitary and self-centered. And until you figure that out, everything they do is a little bit weird. But once you do figure it out, all of a sudden everything they do makes complete sense. So they're a bit enigmatic, yes.
How much time do you spend with them?
Not as much as I used to. A lot of my time nowadays is on aeroplanes and going to meetings and with government and donors and press and media and all these things. But I do still get out into the forest probably at least once a month. And it's a thrill still to do that.
Mm. Yeah. What was your reaction when you learned about this new species?
Well, we knew these orangutans were there from quite a while back. I mean, we surveyed a lot of forests in the late 90s to see exactly which forest patches still did have orangutans, because there was lots of rumors at the time. We found that the Batang Toru forest did still have orangutans, but we thought that was just like the most southern population of the what we always knew as the Sumatran orangutan. It's only in recent years, after looking at the DNA and recently the taxonomy and morphology and everything, that we realized it's a completely different species.
Paint us a picture overall of what we're currently facing. According to the Orangutan Conservancy, there are between 50,000 and 65,000 orangutans left in the wild.
Yeah, but most of those are in Borneo. And in Borneo, the forests are being clear-felled big time for the expansion of palm oil. In Sumatra, a lot of those, the lowland forests already went several decades ago. So of those orangutans, probably, 45,000 or so are in Borneo. And in Sumatra, we only have around 14,000 left, of which only 800 or so are the Pongo tapanuliensis, the new species.
Are there major differences between the orangutans that live in Borneo and those that live in Sumatra?
I think to your average guy in the street, you wouldn't really notice the difference. But when you work with them every day. There are many differences, yes. The two islands are... In Borneo, there's no volcanoes, whereas in Indonesia... In Sumatra, there's a lot of volcanoes, and most of the soils are brand new because there was a huge volcano in northern Sumatra at Lake Toba, bigger than Yellowstone even. And so all the soils are new, and that means that the forests are much more productive. And so you have everything living at much higher densities in Sumatra than you do in Borneo. So the way they've adapted to deal with the conditions and the forest they're living in is different. So there are subtle differences in their ecology. When you look at them, I mean, I always joke that the Sumatran orangutans are way more better looking than the Bornean orangutans, but it's actually true. They have these much bigger, fuller, more golden beards than they do in Borneo. So if you see an orangutan and the beard is the same color as the body hair, then it's Bornean. But the Sumatrans, they always have a very distinct appearance.
And they're very strong, right?
Super strong, yeah. I mean, I worked with them in zoos, and people always say, well, 7 or 8 times stronger than a human being. But it's true, yes. An adult male would weigh around 110 kilograms, and he would be carrying that weight on his shoulders and his biceps most of the day, every day. And so, yeah, they're famous in zoos for destroying enclosures and things because they not only are they super strong, but they also, because they're more solitary than the other apes, they'll sit and focus and work on things. Mm. So, yeah, you talk to any zookeeper and they'll tell you about all the nuts and bolts that they undo and bring there and trade for bananas and things like that, yeah.
Do you think they should be in zoos?
I think, it's a very good question, yeah, because I come from a zoo background. And when I first worked in zoos with orangutans, it was in a zoo where the enclosures were not so good. And I always felt a bit depressed when I came back from Indonesia, having seen them in the wild. But then we built a brand new enclosure, and they had a huge island with grass and trees and ropes and everything else. And I thought, actually, it's not so bad because, you know, they have everything that's provided for them. And nobody is shooting them, and nobody's burning them, and nobody's pouring petrol on them and setting them alight and hacking them to bits with a machete. Mm. So I think if they're in a good zoo, I think they're reasonably well off. Yeah.
I'm so afraid we're going to get to a point where we say, well, the elephant, the giraffe, it's not being killed in a zoo, so let's keep them in zoos. I mean, it's just...
Well, you get to rhinos then. I mean, there's been a few incidents where people have gone into zoos at night under cover of darkness and killed rhinos and poached their horns. It's a scary world out there.
Mm. Describe to us what their environment looks and feels like. I was watching a video about the new species of orangutan on your website, and it's just so lush and so beautiful. Can you describe what that looks like and feels like?
I spent a lot of time wandering around in swamp forests, so I'm a particularly partial to swamp forests, which are wet all the time and itchy and horrible and sweaty. Dryland forests over there are a little bit easier, but it is a beautiful place. I mean, I live in the city of Medan, which is a big sprawling mass of chaos, you know, around 3.5 million people. But once you get out into the forest, it's a completely different world. The great thing about it is you never know what's going to happen. I mean, wildlife is not sort of dripping off the trees. You have to really look for it and you have to wander around quietly, but it is there. And if you do take the time to sit and watch and look, you get massive rewards. And you never know. In Sumatra especially, we've got tigers and elephants and stuff, so you never know who's watching you. Yeah.
What do the orangutans eat?
They're mostly fruit eaters, usually going up into the high canopy of the big trees and stuffing their face on these fruits. But they eat a surprising number of insects, ants and termites, so animal protein is a big part of the diet. And one of the differences between orangutans in Sumatra and Borneo, actually, is that in Sumatra, if they find these nocturnal primates called slow loris, one of these big-eyed, slow-moving things in the trees, they'll catch them and eat them, and they love them. You know, it's quite weird to see an orangutan sort of picking meat off the bones of a small monkey, but they love them when they find them.
And they only give birth once every 6 to 9 years?
Yeah, actually, in Sumatra, it's longer. It's the 8 to 9 years. In Borneo, it's sort of 6 to 7. So, yeah, that's actually the longest interval between births of any mammal, not just land-living mammals, but including whales, as far as we know.
How much research has been done on this to try to figure out why this happens?
Basically, they're relatively solitary, and the mothers invest a lot in every infant, and survival rates amongst young infant orangutans are very high because of that. So rather than sort of throwing out infants and having a high mortality rate, they really focus on the one, and they spend 8 to 9 years looking after that one 24 hours a day, making sure it survives.
Wow. Can you tell us more about that relationship? Because I love seeing the photos of the mom with the baby.
It's very strong. I mean, how do you compare it? I mean, people think about humans and the care that they give to their kids, but you share responsibility with your grandma and your aunties and all this kind of stuff. Well, the orangutans are out there in the forest on their own. They can't sort of share responsibility with anybody, so the mothers just spend 24 hours a day looking after those kids.
We also read in National Geographic that orangutan males prefer older, experienced females.
I think that's speculation. I mean,
we were wondering about that.
I don't know where you would find the scientific basis for that one.
Are there any other intriguing facts about orangutans?
I mean, there are many, yeah. Where would you want to start?
What are some of your favorites?
Well, one of the ones where I did my PhD, we went into swamp forests on the west coast of Sumatra. And prior to that, any zookeeper in the world that works with orangutans will know that they are way out ahead of the other apes in terms of tool use in captivity. Mm. But nobody had seen them using tools in the wild until a friend of mine, Carl van Schaik, went and established a new research center on the west coast in the peat swamps. And when he went in there, he found the orangutans there were making and using tools on an almost daily basis. They'll break off little twigs and fray the ends a bit and use them to get honey out of bees' nests and to eat the seeds of this particularly hard, nasty fruit that's like concrete. That's quite unusual too, because many years ago people thought, well, what's the difference between apes and humans, or humans and animals, basically. And then Jane Goodall found the chimpanzees in Africa using tools to get termites out of termite hills. And everybody thought, well, chimps are way ahead, but the orangutans do the same thing.
Yeah. Today we are speaking with Dr. Ian Singleton, Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation and Scientific Director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program. He lives in Indonesia. He's lived there for the last 21 years, but he's in the Bay Area giving talks about orangutans. According to the Orangutan Conservancy, there are between 50,000 and 65,000 left in the world. Most are in Borneo. Dr. Ian Singleton works with orangutans in Sumatra. 2,000 to 3,000 are killed every year, mostly because of deforestation, palm oil plantations, illegal hunting, and the illegal pet trade. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Ian Singleton, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Well, let's talk about what's currently happening to the orangutans. You talked about the lush forests, where they live. What happens when their habitat is destroyed?
Well, I mean, usually these days, it's for palm oil plantations, and that's areas of like 10 to 20,000 hectares. So big swathes of land are cleared in a relatively short space of time. And so the problem for orangutans and everything else is that you go from a primary rainforest where you've got thousands, if not millions of species per hectare to almost nothing. So they'll chop the forest down and then they'll incinerate what's left and kill just about every living thing that was there, including toadstools and mushrooms and mosses and lichens. And so a few of the orangutans that are in there, they may find their way into some adjacent forest, if there is any, but that's probably already full of orangutans and there's only so much food around. So they end up dying of malnutrition and starvation, or they come out and raid farmers' crops and they get shot for their trouble. And you can imagine a couple of guys maybe chopping down the last few trees and there's an orangutan up there and they think it's fun to chop the tree down and then see what happens, and they end up clubbing the orangutan to death or chopping it into pieces or shooting it. And if there's an infant that survives that process, then it's those kind of infants that end up getting taken home and enter in the pet trade.
Can you name some of these palm oil corporations?
I could name a lot of them. I don't know if it's wise to do so.
Would we find any of these names familiar in the States?
Yes, you probably would, yeah. What you would find very familiar is the products.
Right. I mean,
this palm oil ends up in cosmetics and
candies.
Lipsticks and candies and biscuits, and you'd be amazed what companies are out there.
I have an article from The Guardian called Nestle, Hershey and Mars Breaking Promises Over Palm Oil Use. But before we... And the photo is just horrible. But before we talk about this, how do these palm oil companies get the permission? Do they sign agreements with the Indonesian government to do this? How does that work?
Yeah, you need to get what they call a HGU, or a permit to use the land for business. And so they'll go to the government and apply for those, and then that will be approved probably by local government. And then once you get that, you're in. But there's a lot of social conflicts as well with the people, because a lot of people over there, you can imagine a village where there's several people and they own bits of land, but they don't have any paperwork because it's been in the family for generations. And these people are evicted from the land because they can't compete with the permit. It's not just the orangutans that get removed from these areas. It's the human people as well. Yeah.
Can you tell us about the Indonesian government? And I'm sure there's so much news about palm oil. It kind of comes in waves, but there's pressure on the government to take action on this. Have they changed at all, or do they continue just issuing permits?
I think it's the power of the lobby. I mean, the more I've got to know about this industry, the more I realize that most of these companies are not Indonesian. They're American, they're European, Australian, Malaysian. And so it's the power of the lobby. They're massive global corporations, some of the biggest that exist. And the power they have over who gets elected in a country like Indonesia is incredible, you know. So it's how do you change business as usual? But one of the problems that we're dealing with, one of the questions we always get asked is, you know, what are we asking them to do? Are we asking them to stop palm oil? Well, no. We're just asking them, you know, if we could just get them all to follow existing laws within Indonesia, most of our problems would go away overnight. It's because they flout the rules. You know, they're maybe all their permits are not 100% watertight, or they're logging areas outside their concession, or they're breaking the law in other ways. You know, so if they just all followed the laws, half of our problem would go away.
Mm. Tell us more about the palm oil specifically, how it's extracted. What does the fruit itself look like?
It's a big palm, so it's basically a large stem and then loads of fronds, a bit like a coconut tree actually. And then the palms, they grow in, the fruit grows in bunches, and each fruit is about 1.5 inches sort of in size, and maybe about 1,000 of them on a palm, but they're like miniature coconuts. So you get this like orangey husky bit, fibrous bit around the outside, and that's where the palm oil comes from. And then within it, you get this sort of woody kernel, and then inside you get this like little white meat. So it's like a miniature coconut. Yeah, and then they basically just squeeze that and squeeze the oil out of it.
Can you give us a bit of history? Why did companies decide to put palm oil in things like candy bars and cosmetics?
That's probably beyond my skill set, but because consumerism is just, it's going crazy. I mean, I look and see, especially in the US here, you know, people buying things that they really don't need. And people are saying, well, should we, you know, boycott palm oil and switch to something else? I say, well, yeah, but why not just get rid of all of it, you know? Do you really need it in everything? Do you need your lipstick to be that little bit smoother, or do you need your biscuits to be that little bit more chewy? You know, it's just... It's
right.
Insane.
And do we need 20 or 50 brands of potato chips?
Yeah,
right?
Precisely. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the companies that use this palm oil. The Guardian had a piece just a couple weeks ago, and the lead is Nestle, Mars and Hershey have been accused of breaking pledges to stop using, quote, conflict palm oil from deforested Indonesian jungles just days before the Halloween frenzy. They're calling it now conflict palm oil.
Yeah, I mean, that refers to a lot of the social unrest. I mean, it's people, it's companies going into areas, evicting people from their land, destroying conservation areas and all those kind of things, yeah. I mean, there is a lot of conflict out there, and in in many areas it gets very violent. People get killed over this. Yeah.
But the Rainforest Action Network says citizens have been deceived by promises from these brands to clean up their supply chains, because, like I said, this gets attention in waves. A lot of young people are starting campaigns. For example, the Girl Scout cookies were pressured to take palm oil out of the cookies, and they did it. There's a lot of pressure on these companies.
Yeah, but it's not enough. I think you've got to understand the scale and the size of these companies and the power they have. I mean, one of the Indonesia's biggest palm oil company is registered in Indonesia, but ultimately owned by a major multinational corporation based in the UK that has been in Southeast Asia for hundreds of years. It fought the opium wars with the Chinese. It basically owns Hong Kong. I'm refraining from naming this company, but it's a major player. I mean, I'm looking at it and thinking, you know, I'm from the UK. You know, we always hear about the British Empire, but it's never really gone away. It's just changed its modus operandi. You know, it's still running things out there.
Why do you hesitate to name the names?
Because these are big, powerful companies, and they'll lawyer up immediately.
What, has that happened before?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. Today we're speaking with Dr. Ian Singleton, Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation, and he is also Scientific Director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program. On today's One Planet series, we are talking about the state of orangutans. There are about 50,000 to 65,000 left in the wild, most in Borneo. Dr. Ian Singleton works with those in Sumatra and Indonesia. 2,000 to 3,000 orangutans are killed every year, and we've been talking about palm oil use, and this is really important. A lot of people use it in their everyday lives, and they have no idea that it's killing orangutans. So if you have any questions or comments about this, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And you can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a question from Rob, who says, are you familiar with the Sumatran Orangutan Society, and what do you think of the work they're doing?
Yeah, they're based in the UK, and I've known the team there for many, many years since they started. And they're essentially raising funds, mostly in the UK, and supporting some of ourselves and other NGOs based out in Indonesia doing the work on the ground. Yeah,
there are a lot of groups working on this.
Orangutans are quite popular, yeah. I mean, it's actually weird because when I started in zoos in the late 80s, nobody knew what they were. Mm-hmm. They were never on the news. So it was chimpanzees and gorillas everywhere, and zoos built new enclosures for their chimpanzees and gorillas, and the orangutans moved into the old ones. Then during the 90s, they actually started to get more airplay in magazines and TV and everything else. So now everybody's heard about them, but it's only happened in the last sort of couple of decades.
And has much changed at all from the media attention that this is getting?
Yes and no. I mean, people have been sort of confiscating illegal pet orangutans since the early 70s and rehabilitating them. Lots of people have heard about that kind of process. But the numbers that need confiscating and rehabilitation haven't gone down at all, despite all the media attention. They've actually gone up, and it's worse than ever now before. You know, there's currently, we've received in the last 15, 17 years, you know, over 360 orangutans now, confiscated illegal pets. Right now, there's probably more than 1,000 in three rescue centers in Borneo, more than in the entire global zoo population. So despite all the media attention and everything else, the problems they haven't gone away. They've got worse, if anything.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Ian Singleton, Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation and Scientific Director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program. And on today's Your Call One Planet series, we're talking about orangutans. There are between 50,000 and 65,000 left in the wild. 2,000 to 3,000 are killed every year. And a new species was just discovered. The Tapanuli orangutan lives in the Batang Toru Forest on the Sumatra Island in Indonesia, but there are just 800 left. The Tapanuli orangutan is the most endangered of all great apes. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are talking about orangutans with Dr. Ian Singleton, Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation, a nonprofit that focuses on species conservation and environmental education in Switzerland and Indonesia. He's also Scientific Director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program, and he's lived in Indonesia for 21 years. He's on a quick trip to the Bay Area to talk about what we can do to protect protect and save orangutans. And if you have any questions or comments, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. What would you say is most effective when it comes to pressuring these companies to stop using conflict palm oil, companies like Hershey and Nestle?
Well, what I found is that often it's it's a very complicated situation over there. You've got a lot of companies. So for a plantation to have a plantation license, they have to set up an Indonesian company with an Indonesian name. And so you get all these different plantations with different names all over the place. And the question is, you know, who, say you've got a big company over here that's importing palm oil, who are they buying it from? Which plantation is it coming from? And I think in many cases, there may even be these big companies actually don't
California
know.
California makes international so they don't, headlines for leading.
They don't know if their, you know, if their palm oil is coming from a good company or a bad company. And I think that's what we need them to do. We need them to sort of publicly name exactly where they're getting all the palm oil from. We need that chain of custody thing. So then we can go into the ground and we can find out whether this company is breaking the law or following the rules or not. You know,
right.
And report back. But it's this lack of accountability. I mean, I think a lot of these companies are just so used to this Victorian sort of idea that as long as they're putting bread on the table, they can do no wrong. But that's not the way it is these days. Nowadays, they need to be transparent. They need to list exactly where all their palm oil is coming from on the internet so people can go in there and check. And I think it's the companies that do that that will be the most successful. And the ones that try and hide everything, like you know, the way it's always been done, will suffer.
You also need strong enforcement mechanisms.
Yeah, but in order to enforce anything, you need to have the data.
Right,
you need to have the information. And it's they're just so used, all these companies are so used to working with what they call shell companies, yeah, hiding behind other names. So nobody really knows who's doing what. And I think that's what has to really change before we can sort of have confidence in the marketplace.
This is in cookies, candy bars, pizza dough, cosmetics.
Yeah.
What other everyday products are listeners possibly using or
your
eating?
Your shampoo, your lipstick, your makeup, your soap, possibly your detergents in the house that you clean the kitchen sink with. It's all over the place.
Have you checked your labels to find out if palm oil is in your products? So what are your thoughts about this? I mean, palm oil gets attention. Like I said, I feel like it goes in waves. And now with so much happening in this country, we have like a crisis every day. It's hard now to kind of bring these things up to get them the attention they deserve. I've been hearing a lot about fair and sustainable palm oil. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there is this thing called the Round Table on Sustainable Palm Oil, and that was essentially founded after the World Wildlife Fund sort of started to criticize the industry, and one of the big players, Unilever, said, okay, let's sit down and talk about it. And then they sort of agreed that they needed to get more stakeholders in. They needed to get the retailers, the manufacturers, the banks who are financing in the industry, the NGOs, the social NGOs, the environmental NGOs. And so they founded this thing called the Round Table on Sustainable Palm Oil. And then they sort of said, well, you know, how can we change things? What can we do? So they set up they decided they would have a sort of a sustainable labeling system. So if they follow all these rules, what they call principles and criteria, in theory, you could be then claim to be producing sustainable palm oil. Now, what is sustainable palm oil? That's a very, very difficult one. But I find the RSPO, I find it, I like the idea of it. I think all industries in the world, you know, the big industries should have that opportunity for dialogue between the consumers and the retailers and the finances and everything. And so I think the RSPO is a step in the right direction. But it's still a prototype, and there's still a long way to go. I mean, people say, well, if I buy RSPO-certified sustainable palm oil, is it sustainable? Well, it depends on your definition of sustainability. I was reading a book a while back which was explaining how we're destroying soils like 4 or 5 times faster than soils are being created on this planet, and so by default, nothing is sustainable.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Ian Singleton. He's scientific director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program. Let's talk a little bit more about the new species. You've been working on this for a long time, and you wrote a paper on it, the Tapanuli orangutan, which lives in the Batang Toru Forest in Indonesia. What is different between the Tapanuli orangutan and other orangutans?
Well, if you look at them on the outside, they look like Sumatran orangutans. They have these big golden beards, but they are a little bit more delicate, and their hair is a little bit frizzier. But it's when you look at the DNA, and the DNA evidence shows us that they actually split from the other Sumatran orangutans around 3.4 million years ago, and separated fully from Bornean orangutans around 700,000 years ago. So they are quite distinct. But on the outside, they look like Sumatrans.
And just 800 left.
Yeah. In 150,000 hectares of forest. But those 800 are already split into two, actually three, groups. So there's a major road that bisects the forest, and so you've got about 600 on one side and 200 on the other side.
You talked a little earlier about what went on behind the scenes to find this species. It took 4 years of research involving 37 scientists from 10 countries, including Malaysia and Indonesia, to make this discovery?
Yeah. I mean, the original research was more of an investigation of the genetics of the remaining orangutan populations. And so we found that there is a little bit of variation around Borneo and a bit of variation around Sumatra. But it was the Batang Toru ones that stood out as quite different. And so, yeah, it kind of came from a more general study of the genetics of all orangutan populations.
You're someone who dedicates your life to this work. I mean, what does this mean to you? This new species was just discovered, but there are only 800 left.
It actually makes our work harder. You know, we really need to focus on protecting those forests and actually reconnecting those two isolated forest patches. But it also means that the other orangutans further north in Sumatra, the old Sumatran orangutan or Pongo abeli, is also more endangered. It's just lost 800 animals that we thought it had before.
Jules Howard is a zoologist, and there was an article in The Guardian in which he was quoted, and he wrote or said, "Future paleontologists will look at the plight of fossil apes and the geological strata being laid down in our current age and wonder why we let them, of all species, dwindle. Perhaps those early humans thought the other apes stupid, they will wonder. Perhaps other apes threatened the early humans' resources, they will think. Perhaps they tasted good. The truth will be far more embarrassing. We let them go because of just sort of we forgot about them. So let's try not to. Let's keep shining that mirror on ourselves. Let's talk about the plight of great apes. The world gained a new species, but we, all of us, gained a new family member, a creature who differs from us by degree, not type. The least we could do is look out for it a bit."
Can't argue with that one. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, and the other thing is, it's apes. It's so many creatures. I mean, we've done so many shows about the sixth mass extinction. Hmm. And it's getting a lot of attention, but it seems like the numbers are just, they continue to dwindle.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, when I started my wildlife career, I was more into, like, snakes and amphibians and things like that. But it's a reminder that, you know, these orangutans, it's not just about the orangutans. It's every other creature that lives in these forests. And there are masses, and there are some incredible things. You know, flying snakes and flying frogs and rhinos in the jungle. And there's a rabbit in Sumatra that lives in the jungle and is not wiped out by predators. There's a whole plethora of, like, amazing creatures in these forests, not just the orangutan. So saving the great apes, you know, is massive knock-on effects. Mm.
You talked a little bit about the changes you would like to see. I mean, actually, the enforcement of law would be a nice start. But when you're talking about this bigger picture of extinction, what other changes would you like to see?
I would like to see people understand that this is it's a global issue. I mean, the highest densities of orangutans in Indonesia are in peat swamp forests. And peat is basically, you know, these are forests on wet, boggy areas, and under the ground is peat. It's basically all the living things that died and fell in the water and didn't decompose. So it's massive stocks of carbon. You know, Indonesia has around 56% of all the world's tropical peatlands, and locked up in those peatlands is around 4 to 16 times the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere today. So when we're fighting for orangutan habitat to save the orangutans, we're actually fighting for, you know, human existence. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, you know, when you lose these forests, it impacts everybody, and everybody needs to care about it.
Dr. Ian Singleton is Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation and Scientific Director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program. He's lived in Indonesia for 21 years, dedicating his life to saving and protecting orangutans, and he's in the Bay Area giving talks about the plight of orangutans, what needs to be done to ensure that they survive. There are between 50,000 and 65,000 left in the wild, most in Borneo. Ian works with those in Sumatra. 2,000 to 3,000 orangutans are killed every year, mostly from palm oil plantations. Is that the main reason why they're being killed?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that end up as illegal pets are a side effect or a byproduct of habitat loss. And the biggest driver of habitat loss is the palm oil industry. Yeah.
We have an email from Sue who says, I don't eat a lot of processed foods, but the few I do, such as vegan cheese, concern me because the whole purpose of my being a vegan is not to harm animals. Sometimes a label will state that the palm oil is responsibly farmed or something to that effect. Is there such a thing, we talked about this a little bit earlier, as palm oil that does not harm orangutans or displace humans? I guess we'd have to do a show about what this means, right? Because a lot of it's, it comes from Ghana, the responsible palm oil.
I believe there's a plantation in Ghana somewhere producing organic palm oil.
Okay.
But essentially, it's all replaced forests. I mean, you can be certified now as producing so-called sustainable palm oil, but because you haven't chopped down forests in the last 15 years. But 20, 30, 40, 100 years ago, it was all forests. So all of it's replaced forests. And I sympathize with you. If you're trying to be a vegan, you know, you're it's a nightmare. But there is labeling, and there's the U.S. zoos are actually quite active in that. I think the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo in particular has a website with a long list of all the different names that palm oil goes under in your ingredients list, and there are many different ones. So you can go to websites like that and find out the names to avoid.
It seems like at a time when these companies are so concerned about their image and their brand, massive amounts of citizens need to shame them on social media and really speak out about this.
Yeah, I think companies need to be accountable. I mean, it struck me that, 20 years ago in Indonesia, there was a Greenpeace criticized a pulp and paper company and said, you're doing this in the middle of your concession. And they went, no, we're not, prove it. You know? Well, nowadays you can prove it. You can go in there and you can zoom in satellite imagery and you can measure stuff and you can count people and diggers on the ground and bulldozers. And you can start right into these companies and ask them, you know, are you buying from these people? Are you responsible for these fires or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's that what we need to have. This is the age of transparency, and I think the progressive companies are the ones who who take the initiative and actually become the most open and transparent. And the ones who try and avoid doing that, you know, they're living in the dark ages, and they'll suffer.
Well, thank you for the email, Sue. You can email us yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call if you have any questions or comments about orangutans and palm oil, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Linda called in. She couldn't stay on the line, but she visited an orangutan sanctuary in the 80s run by a brother and sister in Sumatra. Are you familiar with the sanctuary? Do you know if it's still around?
In the 80s. Yeah, that's probably my boss, actually, at the Pan Eco Foundation, Regina. She was one of the founders of the Bohorok, or Bukit Lawang, Rehabilitation Center in Sumatra back then. And then she was... They were replaced, took over by Conrad and Rosalind Aveling. So that's probably when they went there, yes. But that would be the Bohorok, or now it's known as Bukit Lawang Rehabilitation Center.
How many rehabilitation centers are there?
Nowadays, there's probably about 5. But the whole process began in the 60s when a woman called Barbara Harrison wrote a paper and said, everybody's stealing orangutans and catching orangutans in the forests, and we need to confiscate them, return them. So a lot of centres set up. It's Sepilok in Malaysian Borneo and down in Indonesian Borneo as well, and Sumatra. But then people started to realise that actually these orangutans are not coming out the forests, and putting them into this forest where there's existing wild orangutan populations is probably not the right thing to do. No matter how careful you are, there's always a risk of releasing some disease, but there's food competition. There's only so much food to go around. So you put in another 50 or 100 orangutans into an area and somebody's going to go hungry. Mm-hmm. And people started to realise these orangutans are not coming from forests. They're coming from areas where there used to be forests, but the forests have gone. You know, these pet orangutans are actually effectively refugees from forests that don't exist anymore.
I've watched a number of videos about the amazing people who rehabilitate orangutans. A lot of locals work at these sanctuaries. Can you tell us about some of their stories?
I mean, we've got a whole bunch of young girls and boys from the local villages. And when they first start working, you know, it's just a job. But, you know, within days, they're actually saying, oh, my God, these animals are smart. You know, it's not just like looking after chickens, you know. So I've seen a lot of people whose entire attitude to the environment around them is transformed because they worked in one of these centres. And the vets are amazing too. You know, you got these young Indonesian vets. You know, the vet schools are not as good as the ones in Europe and the US, but they're so dedicated. You know, they'll get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and drive 12 hours across the island to get an orangutan and bring it back and care for it. You know, it's amazing to see this kind of dedication. And it's, you know, I remember the days when all the conservation organizations were run by expat Westerners, you know. And now we're seeing more and more NGOs coming up that are founded and managed and run by Indonesians, and they're very good at it. And that's really heartwarming. It gives you, you know, you see a lot of depressing stuff, but occasionally there's a reason for optimism too.
And that's really important because this is a local person talking about why other locals should care about this issue rather than a white man coming in saying, this is why you need to save the orangutans.
Yeah, precisely. Right? But, I mean, the irony, too, is that, you know, people say, you know, Ian, why are Indonesians chopping down their forests? And I say, well, they're not. You know, this is massive multinational corporations. It's American companies and European companies and Australian companies and Malaysian. It's hardly ever Indonesian companies. You know, all the Indonesians are doing are watching. They're watching their assets and their natural resources being plundered by foreign multinationals and brokered by a few very powerful Indonesians who are making billions of dollars out of it, and everybody else is just getting robbed.
What is the sentiment of the Indonesian population?
They feel that. They feel that their environment is being trashed, their livelihoods are being destroyed, and their potential for long-term economic development is being trashed as well, at the expense of the short-term profit and greed of somebody who probably never even been to the local area. You know? Most of the money from this industry goes straight out of the local areas into the capital cities or abroad. Most of it goes abroad.
Is there a movement in Indonesia among locals to raise awareness about this and put pressure on their government to stop giving permits to these companies unless laws are enforced?
Yes, a huge movement. And the government even has made commitments to review and not grant new permits and to review existing permits and all these other things. It's just that it's so slow coming through, and the business lobby is so powerful that it kind of carries on anyway.
Talk a little bit more about how local communities are impacted by palm oil. You talked about some people are literally forced from their homes to make way for these corporations. What else? How else are they affected?
Well, I mean, I live in the city of Medan. It's just across the border from Aceh province, which you've probably heard of because of the tsunami. But the Losa ecosystem, which is a major forest block up there where 85% of all Sumatra's orangutans still live, it's there because it's still forested because it's extremely rugged mountainous terrain, steep mountainous terrain. And the people there traditionally knew that if you mess with these forests, there are serious consequences. You know, entire hillsides come down the river and destroy your house. But that happens naturally. You know, occasionally you get heavy rains or an earthquake or something and you get a big flash flood and a few houses are destroyed. Now, as soon as you go into these watersheds and you clear fell 10,000, 20,000 hectares of forest, a 30-year disaster becomes a 1 year or a 2 year disaster. So a lot of the people up there in Aceh are seeing companies from outside the region going in, taking all the profits out of the region, and all that's left is these natural disasters, or man-made disasters actually, that kill people, destroy entire towns, and cost an awful lot of money. I mean, the World Bank looked at some floods, flash floods in 2006 in just 19 days that cost the local economy $210 million. And this is so you've got to question, you know, there's, I'm always sat there thinking, you know, why is this happening? You know, surely there must be a good economic argument for it. But actually, when you start to look at the economics, you find that the costs are in many cases way higher than the benefits to local economies. So I think there's actually, I'm starting to suspect that there's not even an economic argument for all this destruction.
And then you also have mining, gold mining, hydroelectric dams.
Yeah. We, gold mining, of course we do, all sorts of other mining as well. There's a push as well by the Indonesian government to have more renewable energy programs. The problem is that the business lobby, the powerful lobby, is trying to push for a lot of these schemes to be in conservation areas and protected forests, so that they can, it's an excuse to not only build the project, but to put roads in there and open it up so that in 10, 20 years, they can also expand palm oil growth. You know, it's a, what, you know, the Batang Toru forest is a good example. It's only like 150,000 hectares. It's already got a hydroelectric scheme. It's got a geothermal scheme. They're building a new hydroelectric scheme. Why does this all have to be in these valuable protected forests in these very sensitive areas with all these disaster risks when there are plenty other alternative sites available?
Do you think that, that conservationists who have a seat at the table and have the microphone spend enough time talking about consumption?
It's a difficult one. I mean, we, you know, I often remember reading a book by E.O. Wilson, who said that, you know, this is about 20 years ago, he said that for everybody in the world to have the same standard of living and the same products and everything that the U.S., the average U.S. citizen has, would take four planet Earths. So consumption has to stop somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think we really do have to look at things and say, do we really need it? Or not, you know. I'm really pleased to see that people are now starting to not use plastic bags, but it's taken a long time getting there.
And plastic straws are now getting a lot of attention.
All these things that you just, you know, you buy, I mean, wrapping and everything, you just throw it away. It's crazy.
Let's hear from Arturo in San Francisco. Hi, Arturo. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. I had an acquaintanceship with famous orangutan in San Francisco. His name was Rusty. He has since died of years ago, maybe 10 years ago. But in any case, at the time of my friendship with Rusty, the thought occurred to me that perhaps satellite populations of orangs could be established in friendlier, more stable parts of the world than Indonesia, because even then, there was pressure on the population. I can recall at least one American who was making an attempt to seek international help in establishing some protections for them. That's it. No more.
Interesting idea. I think Rusty was, didn't he end up in Hawaii? He was taken in and looked after by the Orangutan Foundation International, I believe.
I do know that he died maybe 10 years ago, but he was actually active in the zoo in one way or another at the time, and I found that he could actually recognize me in among a crowd of hundreds of onlookers. That's an interesting experience you don't quite forget. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all. But the people have talked about reintroducing orangutans to areas outside of Indonesia, including the Andaman Islands, I remember many years ago. But we are kind of doing that in Sumatra. We're actually in Sumatra, most of the orangutans are up in the Losa ecosystem in the Batang Toru forest, and we are confiscating illegal pets, and we're introducing them in the south, in Jambi province, into the Bukit Tiga Puluh National Park, and in the far north of Aceh, into Janto. And in both locations, we want to release over 350 orangutans over the next couple of decades, and gradually establish brand new viable wild populations of the species. As far as I know, we're the only people in the world actually doing that, trying to establish self-sustaining viable wild populations of a great ape species. But that's within Sumatra, and the areas where we're doing that did historically have orangutan populations, you know, a few 100 or 1,000 years ago. So we're kind of reinstating these populations in forests that they did, where they did once exist. I think if you go into other areas where orangutans never existed, you've got all these other species. I mean, if you released orangutans, for example, in the Andaman Islands, I'm sure you'd have loads of ornithologists and herpetologists, you know, screaming blue murder because you're going to destroy the habitat of this particular frog or this particular snake or bird or whatever. So there are always consequences when you go outside the historic range. But I think as long as you can justify that you're establishing a population of a species that did once live in this habitat, then no problem.
Well, thank you for the call, Arturo, and thank you for sharing that story. We have an email from Michael who says the Buycott app has good info on palm oil companies and products. It's Buycott, Buycott.
Mm-hmm.
Final thoughts, Ian, what people can do?
I think, you know, people need to firstly realize that what's going on in Indonesia is not necessarily driven by Indonesians. They're being robbed as well. You know, it's all driven by ourselves, Western lifestyles and consumption and everything else. Mm. And so the answer, the solution to the problem, is also should also be with ourselves. You know, we're the ones who should be. It's our companies, it's our people who are going there and destroying the forests, and the Indonesians are just sitting there and watching it happen. So we need to take the lead. We need to start asking companies, you know, where are they getting their palm oil from? Are they sustaining? Are they supplied by sustainable companies? If they can't tell you where they're getting it from, why not? You know, we need to go out there and find out why these things are happening. So it's accountability. And these big companies, they need to understand and they need to be accountable and transparent. But they will only do that if we ask them to be and we force them to be. So it's public pressure. Start writing to companies and finding out, you know, can they guarantee that all their palm oil supplies are from sustainable sources or not? If not, why not?
Dr. Ian Singleton is Director of Conservation at the Pan Eco Foundation and Scientific Director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program. Ian, thank you so much for your work and thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.